Good morning, church. I want to say that while Zoom and Facebook Live have their place and are very helpful, I long for the day that we can be together in person again in our beautiful church. I'm truly thankful for a vestry that has taken the time to look at the COVID situation carefully and realistically, and that has the welfare of all of us at heart. As a person who has had to make decisions about other people in COVID on a daily basis, I can say that I appreciate their struggle. While I don't like the decision to delay the reopening of church, I must say that I understand it and agree with it. To the members of the vestry, I say bless you and thank you. This morning, it is not my intention to preach, at least not in the way I typically do. This morning, I'm going to share with you some experiences in my life. A series of vignettes, if you will, some glimpses of the life I have lived as a Black person in America. I'm going to talk about race and racism this morning, but I'm going to share rather than lecture, preach, or teach. I'm going to take the micro approach. I want to be clear about something first, however. While I think that we as Blacks, as a people, have a common experience and share a bond, we are all very different. Black people come from very different backgrounds. In our congregation, I suggest that while there's something all the members of color hold in common, there's a lot about us that is very different. Our economic and educational backgrounds are different. The notion that to be Black is synonymous with being poor and from the city is simply wrong. How we encounter and deal with racism is also different. What we call ourselves may be different. In my lifetime, we have been called Negro, colored, Afro-American, Black, and most recently, African-American. And those are just the respectful terms. I, myself, am most comfortable with the term Black. I'm not sure why, I just am. It's probably an indication of my age. That does not mean, however, that I am bothered by or have an issue with the label African-American. I'm going to share with you a few of my experiences of racism in America over the years, this Black man's experiences. I am not attempting to represent my people or speak for them. I'm speaking only for and about me. My father's side of the family has its roots in North Carolina. A group of siblings, including my father, migrated to Philadelphia. My father then joined the Navy and went to Great Lakes Naval Training Center. He met my mother while on leave in Chicago, where he settled after the war. I remember taking a trip to Philadelphia in about 1960, where we spent some time in Philadelphia and then all form a train of cars, four or five, to take the trip to the family home in North Carolina. I remember that it was important that we not lose each other, that the cars traveled together. You see, we will be traveling in the Deep South, and there was safety in numbers. White men and police would be more reluctant to harass and exploit us if we were together. Safety, even from the police, was a consideration for Black people traveling this nation's highways. I remember that at a certain point in the trip, we would stop and leisurely use the facilities, drink water, buy soda, etc. The reason was after this point, there would be no decent facilities accessible to us until we got to the farm. I was led to understand that this was the Mason-Dixon line, the point in which Jim Crow segregation laws and customs took effect. Roadside bathrooms, restaurants, and stores would be white only. And to deviate from the highway and find facilities that were accessible to Negroes was time-consuming and uncertain. As a young child, I remember my aunt disappearing into the woods to use the bathroom, because she couldn't use the bathroom at the service station. This was my first experience with overt racism, a racism that was blatant and made it abundantly clear that having dark skin was not only different, it was undesirable. My skin color made me not worthy of the privileges and convenience afforded to white people. Later in my childhood, I went to Boy Scout camp. Now, summer scout camp was not only a place to have fun, it was also a place to work towards your objectives. It was my goal to become an Eagle Scout, and to do that, there were a number of merit badges that were required, many of which I only had the opportunity to earn at summer camp. So when I was about 13 in about 1965, I arrived at a WASFE Scout reservation in the state of Michigan for my first 2 week stay with a plan. I immediately registered to take the merit badge classes I needed. I was approached by the white camp director who wanted to have a talk with me about my plans for the encampment. He was very nice to me, even fatherly. He encouraged me to have fun doing all the things in the woods of Michigan that I couldn't do in the city of Chicago. He advised me to not spend the time working. I explained to him that I had to get these merit badges while in camp because they were required to be an Eagle and that I couldn't get them in Chicago. He gently explained to me that my goals were beyond my reach. He told me that colored boys did not become Eagles. He told me to just have fun. You see, according to him, becoming an Eagle required diligence and intelligence, something I just did not have. After all, he said, Eagles became presidents. Eagles went to the nation's military academies like West Point. Negroes didn't do things like that, he told me. And be clear, this man thought he was doing the right thing. He was every bit a racist as the whites who maintained the Jim Crow South. But he thought of himself as being helpful. He perceived himself as a friend of the Negroes. He saw himself as saving me from frustration and disappointment. If you told him he was a racist, he would have been bewildered and devastated. Some years later, in about 1970, I was attending Trinity College in Hartford, and my wife, who was also a student, was white. Now, Trinity had very limited married student housing, so we went into the neighborhood surrounding Trinity apartment hunting. In those days, you found apartments through the worn ads in the paper and by signs in the windows. We couldn't find an empty apartment. We would see an ad in the paper and call on the phone to make an appointment to see the apartment. By the time we got to the appointment, the landlord would tell us that the apartment had already been taken. This happened several times. So we decided to skip the paper and walk around and go into houses that had signs in the windows. We went to several. Either no one answered the doorbell, or when they did, they told us that the apartment had just been taken. This went on for weeks, and we were getting anxious about finding some place to live before the semester started. We decided that she would make some appointments and see some apartments by herself. She found four empty apartments and landlords that were willing to rent to her on the first day that she tried without her Black husband. Please note that this was not 1950s Deep South Montgomery, Alabama. This was up north, 1970s, Hartford, Connecticut. Later in the mid-80s, my wife and I bought a house in the west end of Hartford, about a block from the West Hartford line. The woman down the block named Janice sold us her Ford Probe that she had bought new and was now about 2 years old. The Probe was a sporty little car. Janice was white, just like my wife. Now, Janice had put no license plate on the front of the Probe as required by law because she didn't think it was sexy. Her word, not mine. My wife, who was going to be the principal user of the Probe, agreed with Janice, so we didn't put a front plate on it ourselves. My wife had an office in Torrington, Connecticut, so on a daily basis, she drove from one end of West Hartford to the other with that Probe with no plate on the front. Janice had driven around West Hartford in that Probe for 2 years, minus a license plate on the front. About a month after we bought the car, I drove across the line into West Hartford. I had red lights in my rearview mirror within a block. Two different white women had no problem with no front plate in West Hartford. A Black man in West Hartford had to meet a whole different legal standard. For white women, the lack of a front plate was a statement of their individuality. For a Black man, it was a matter of breaking the law and subject to fine and arrest. In 1980s, West Hartford, Connecticut. The fact that Black men have more encounters with police has less to do with us breaking the law more and more to do with police scrutinizing us and holding us to a different standard. And to bring you to the present, not long ago, I was standing inside the building on the open hearth near the entrance, wearing a shirt and tie with a picture ID around my neck. A white salesman came in and asked the receptionist to speak to the director. One of the guys standing around heard the question and told the salesman that I was the director while pointing directly at me. The salesman walked right past me and approached the client with no tie and no ID around his neck and was white. It's like his brain just couldn't handle the idea that a Black man could be the chief operating officer of an organization the size and reputation of the Open Heart. And when he was redirected by the client and approached me with his hand extended, he seemed genuinely surprised when I looked at his hand and looked him directly in the eye and walked away without uttering a word. These are just a few experiences I have had with racism in America. I could give you several more, but it would be pointless. For those of you who are white, I do not share these experiences with you to make you guilty. Personally, I think guilt is largely a wasted emotion. And I do not think you're responsible for the transgressions of your ancestors or even your friends or family. I do, however, think you are responsible for you. In the past, and especially recently, I have been asked by white people what they can do about racism in America. My recommendations are twofold. One is very personal, one very political. On the personal side, I suggest that you live your lives in such a way that you model on a day-to-day basis that racism is intolerable. Do not tolerate racist words or behaviors in your midst, no matter where you experience it. This includes Uncle Bill's racist comments at the Thanksgiving table. You need to tell Uncle Bill that you will not tolerate it and that if he continues, you will take your leave or kick him out, depending on where you are. Your children and grandchildren must see you take a stand, even against someone you love. And the same thing you do in your personal life, you must do in your business and public life. Acquiescence in racism is acceptance of racism. And acceptance of racism is support of racism. Elder Cleaver had it right when he said you are either part of the solution or you are part of the problem. On the political side, you need to get out and vote. We need to vote like we have never voted before. We have made tremendous progress in this nation over the past 60 years. We have by no means eliminated racism, but we have come a long way. But trust me, all that progress is at risk. We need to vote like all that progress is at risk. We need to vote like the very fabric of our society is at risk. And just because the outcome of the presidential election may be a given in Connecticut, that does not give permission not to vote in Connecticut. Connecticut must send an overwhelming and loud repudiation of racism, divisiveness, and intolerance. I'm not telling you who to vote for president. I am telling you what ideals you must vote against. We must make it clear that closing our borders to needy brown children of God is unacceptable. We must make it clear that cowards that carry assault weapons and embrace Nazi ideas are not good people too. We must vote and we must get our children to vote and we must get our decent neighbors to vote. Our fear that our vote is our only viable solution to the ugly head of racism that has reared itself over the last 4 years. We must vote against the ideas that racism, bigotry, and intolerance are honorable and acceptable in the United States of America. We must vote in overwhelming numbers. We must leave no doubt as to what values are acceptable in this country. You want to know what you can do about racism? Vote and get everybody you know that believes in justice and equality to vote. This election in November is not just about politics. It's not just about different political philosophies or principles or priorities. This election is about morals. It is about basic human principles. It is about whether America will be on the side of justice and decency or not. It is about whether or not we will return America to its darkest days. What can you do about racism, you ask? Go out there and send the message that racist dog whistle rhetoric will not be tolerated in the White House, nor will people who acquiesce in it be allowed in the Senate or the House of Representatives. On the 55th anniversary of what has become known as Bloody Sunday, on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Representative John Lewis said, 55 years ago, a few of our children attempted to march across this bridge. We were beaten. We were tear gassed. I thought I was going to die on this bridge. But somehow, in some way, God Almighty helped me here. We cannot give up now. We cannot give up. We must keep the faith, keep our eyes on the prize. We must go out and vote like we have never, ever voted before. I'm not going to give up, and I'm not going to give in. We're going to continue to fight. We need your prayers now more than ever before. We must use the vote as a nonviolent instrument or tool to redeem the soul of America. I'm going to repeat myself here. I'm going to close by repeating what John Lewis said. We cannot give up now. We cannot give it up. We must keep the faith, keep our eyes on the prize. We must go out and vote like we never, ever voted before. I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to give in. We're going to continue to fight. We need your prayers now more than ever. We must use the vote as a nonviolent instrument to redeem the soul of America.